Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Allison. So as I was setting down to start writing this introduction yesterday, Wednesday, I was looking at, you know, the brewing trade war between the United States and, well, you know, the rest of the world.
Yeah.
France is being impacted by this 20% trade tariff on imports from the EU, which would hit France's aeronautics industry, its luxury goods, its wine. But then, of course, that all changed, or at least we're paused.
Yeah. U.S. President Donald Trump suddenly announced a U-turn. Surprise.
Yeah.
He was suspending all tariffs, except those on China, for 3 months.
Yeah, so the EU's tariff now goes from 20% to 10%. That base 10% on all imports stays. It's whiplash. And then, you know, just hours before Trump's reversal, the French government cut its 2025 growth forecast. Of course, this is, you know, the number that all spending is based on and budgets and everything. So the economy minister, Eric Lombard, said this was because of, you know, what else? Uncertainty over world trade. The government had forecast annual growth of 0.9% when it presented its 2025 budgets a few weeks ago. Lombard said yesterday, Wednesday, that this would go down to 0.7%. The Bank of France had already lowered its own forecast to 0.7% last month. Others are even forecasting even lower, 0.5%. The minister said that future forecasts would depend on trade negotiations.
So what about this pause then in the tariffs? What do we know about it?
Yeah, well, you know, so he said, the pause is good news, but we must remain calm. That's the quote. The Bank of France governor was more direct. He said the U.S. Move brings us back to reality and a sense of economic realism. But he warned that the U.S. policy remained unpredictable and that there would be negative impacts in Europe. When you peel back the diplomatic veneer of these reactions, you see that there really is this major concern about stability. The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen today said in a statement that clear and predictable conditions are essential for trade and supply chains to function. I'd say that's putting it mildly.
Monsieur le Président, je vous fais une lettre que vous lirez peut-être. Si vous avez le temps, je viens de recevoir mes papiers militaires pour partir à la guerre avant mercredi soir.
Sarah, France is the world's second largest exporter of arms after the US. Did you know that?
Yeah, I it's been in the air, and it is big business.
It is. The sector currently rakes in 30 billion euros in turnover per year. 22 billion of that comes from French public orders and 8 from third parties. Production has increased considerably since the war in Ukraine kicked off in February 2022. In June of that year, President Emmanuel Macron said France was entering into a war economy, and he called on industry to be more innovative, produce more and quicker.
Yeah, and the situation's become even more pressing since Trump entered the White House, threatening first to withdraw support from Ukraine, leaving the EU to fill the gap, then threatening to leave NATO, also leaving the EU to protect itself against possible Russian aggression. There's also been talk of switching from America's nuclear umbrella to protection under France's nuclear missiles.
Yeah, the jury is still out on that one.
Yeah.
But it's clear that France wants to reinforce its armed forces and weaponry. It's become a real priority. And this has pushed arms manufacturers like KNDS into the limelight. KNDS is a joint Franco-German defence group, half-owned by the French state. It produces armoured vehicles, artillery systems, guns, ammunition. It's France's only remaining gun barrel manufacturer. They equip armoured vehicles with those famous Caesar self-propelled howitzers that are being delivered to Ukraine. RFI's Justine Fontaine spoke to staff at the Bourges site in central France to see how they're managing the scale-up.
Ici, on est dans la dernière canonnerie de France. C'est de là que sortent tous les canons de l'artillerie française.
We're in France's last gun barrel factory, says Gabrielle Massoni, KNDS's spokesperson. All French cannon artillery are made here. 90% of the ammunition they produce in France goes to Ukraine, but also many of its Caesar cannons, these 8-metre-long, 3-tonne metal tubes. Massonnet says the company clicked into war economy mode even before President Macron issued instructions.
We've invested 600 million euro over the last 3 years to triple our production capacity for the Caesar cannons and the 155mm shells that they fire. We've taken on staff, bought machinery, and we're extending our premises, so we have this experience of the war economy.
Before the Russian invasion, the company was making between 1 and 2 Caesar cannons per month. Now it's between 6 and 8. Kevin is one of the 200 highly skilled employees on the cannon production line. He joined a decade ago.
Ça a doublé au niveau effectif dans la ligne depuis que je suis arrivé.
The number of staff on the production line has doubled since I arrived, he says. With the increase in demand, we've even been asked to work Saturdays on a voluntary basis. KNDS works with around 2,000 suppliers. They've had to step up the pace too, says Laurent Monzauge, general manager of the Bourges site.
Tous nos fournisseurs, on les a accompagnés.
We supported all our suppliers. We couldn't have KNDS being able to manufacture 8 guns a month and our suppliers remaining at a capacity of 3 or 4.
90% of their suppliers are in France and 10% elsewhere in Europe.
France doesn't have all the technology. For example, the big lathe that had just went into operation comes from elsewhere in Europe. Unfortunately, no one in France had the capacity or skills to manufacture this type of machine because it had no need for it over the last 20 or 30 years. We're ITAR-free. None of our equipment comes from the United States. It's a question of self-sufficiency, of course.
So ITAR is the International Traffic in Arms Regulations, a set of U.S. rules that govern items on the U.S. munitions list. It's long, pretty hard to escape. It means basically having an American component or some form of U.S. technology in your supply chain will mean the U.S. has a say on what you can do with it.
Yes, and with relations the way they are, that's now turning into a bit of a big issue. France is scrambling to be independent of US influence, but it's tricky.
Yeah, it sounds, though, that's one problem at least this company doesn't have to deal with.
Not on the cannon front, anyway. They didn't want to comment further on other things like ammunitions. They do have a few recruitment challenges. It's hard to find highly skilled welders, for example, who can use this special metal known as HL high-yield steel that has the ability to deform and then snap back into position. So they've set up a training facility nearby to give 1 year specific training for welders to learn to do that. Their order books are, however, full for 3 years, and annual results for 2024 showed that orders were up by 40% over the previous year. That's worth a lot of billions of euros. But beyond that, the issue of financing the war economy more broadly is now the big problem facing France.
Yeah, last month, Macron announced an increase in military spending. So from the current 2% of GDP, going up to 3.5% by 2030, going up from 50 billion a year to 100 billion. That's a lot of money.
It is, isn't it? And given France's massive deficit, one of the highest in Europe, those figures are mind-boggling.
Yeah, especially when you think, what, we had like months of political deadlock, the Barnier government fell over an austerity budget intended to save 60 billion euros. Now we're talking about added billions more in defence.
Yeah, the European Commission has promised an 800 billion euro package. All these billions, you kind of lose track. But anyway, the European Commission has promised an 800 billion euro package for EU member states, including 150 billion in loans. But Macron wants to be sure that France can reinforce its army as soon as possible.
So where's this money going to come from?
Good question. Yeah, the economy minister is, for example, launching a savings scheme to encourage French people to deposit a minimum of 500 euros in the bank. It's a kind of interest-bearing defence fund to help finance the war economy. That's just one measure. I asked Virginie Monvoisin, an economist at the Grenoble School of Management, about France's options.
In a war economy, we don't have a lot of options. You can raise taxes, but I don't know if Macron is in a good position for that. The second option is to borrow on the financial markets. And what's happening right now on the financial markets since a few days?
Very volatile.
Yep. But as the financial markets are so volatile right now because of some of the American policy and so on, maybe the French debt could be interesting.
The French economy minister has advocated this idea of a special defense savings account that your common French person could invest in. What do you think of that idea?
It's quite a good idea because French people are very fond of saving. It's an old habit, you know. We have this amazing, amazing amount of saving, especially since the COVID crisis. During COVID, French people saved a lot of money. So it makes sense. And we have different historical examples that show that it's a policy which could be effective during the Second War.
The Second World War.
You have this patriotic effort among the population. So why not?
The governor of the Bank of France, François Villeroy de Gallo, he has said, you know, there cannot be a new whatever it costs, in the quoi qu'il en coûte, which is what happened during COVID, where the French government did put enormous amounts of money onto the table to keep French businesses in particular going. So he's saying that's not possible. What do you think?
If whatever it costs would be again, in the French policy, it will have a lot of consequences. But what the government says is time are exceptional. So maybe you can make an exception. When it's about war, when it's about geopolitical crisis, it's not just a question of economy anymore.
And then, of course, we have the trade war with tariffs in the US, which involves the defense industry. But all that, of course, keeps changing.
Now, this has to be the most famous song in France, La Marseillaise. It was officially named the French national anthem in 1795.
So 230 years ago today, composed in just a few hours on the night of April the 25th to 26th in 1792 by Claude-Joseph Rouget de Lille. He's a young captain and amateur musician.
And it was just days after the Revolutionary Legislative Assembly had declared war on Leopold II, the Holy Roman Emperor and King of Bohemia and Hungary, and brother of Marie Antoinette. Rouget de Lille called the song Chant de guerre pour l'armée du Rhin, the war song for the Rhine army. It got nicknamed La Marseillaise when it was sung on the streets of Paris by volunteer soldiers who'd marched to the capital from Marseille. Mm. And it quickly became a rallying call to the French Revolution.
It's a pretty bloodthirsty song. It reflects the invasion of France by Prussian and Austrian armies, the references to ferocious soldiers coming to cut the throats of your sons and comrades.
Yeah, and the call to arms, aux armes, citoyens, and causing impure blood to water the fields.
Mm. So we talked about the origins of this song in the early days of the podcast, remember, back in 2019? Ooh. Go listen to it, listeners. I think it was episode 4.
Yeah, we have been around for quite a while. But I thought it was interesting to go back to the Marseillaise because it features in an exhibition at the National Archives in Paris about music and the Republic, how the idea of the French Republic and its values have been expressed, even reinforced, through music. Marie Ranquet, the chief curator in charge of heritage at the National Archives, told RFI's Nathalie Amar that the anthem has stood the test of time.
The Marseillaise was a bit of a common thread for us because from the start it was a hugely successful song and it's still going strong. That's what's interesting. It's successful even when it's out of season. During the Restoration period, for example, from 1814 to 1830, when it was banned, part of the population continued to really cherish it. After the Second Empire, there were several attempts to introduce other national anthems, including at the beginning of the Third Republic in the early 1870s. But in the end, the Marseillaise continued to be used because people felt it was essential.
La Marseillaise qui continue qui reste là parce que elle est en fait incontournable pour ces gens-là.
La Marseillaise was officially reinstated as the national anthem in 1879 under the Third Republic, and it's remained pretty much unchallenged since then, except for the 4 years of the Vichy regime from 1940 to 1944.
Yeah, and there've been many different recordings of the song.
Allons enfants de la
This is Serge Gainsbourg's reggae version, which became a big hit in 1979, although with its strong anti-military bent, it wasn't very popular with the army. La Marseillaise has been adopted and recorded in foreign languages by a whole load of different groups around the world as a song of struggle against authoritarian regimes. The Beatles used a bit of it, you might remember, in the opening fanfare to All You Need Is Love. Verdi and Elgar have sampled the tune. Tchaikovsky incorporated it in his 1812 overture, commemorating not the revolution, of course, but Russia finally beating back Napoleon after the Battle of Borodino. And then there are versions that use the melody, but rework the lyrics to evoke different periods in history, such as the Marseillaise Formisienne. So he sings of the 1st of May sounding the end of so much torture. Let us rise up to demonstrate against the exploiters, he sings.
So why is it called La Fourmisienne? Fourmi means ant.
Yeah, good question. Mm. Fourmi is actually the name of an industrial town in the north of France. And the song commemorates a dramatic event on the 1st of May, 1891. Here's Ranke.
Alors, le 1er mai 1891, c'est la première fois que l'on va fêter.
The 1st of May, 1891, was the first time that Labour Day was celebrated. There was a demonstration by workers and it degenerated. There were clashes with the police. Many people were injured and killed. This was obviously an extremely tragic event and had major repercussions throughout France. And it fueled Jean Jaurès's political commitment.
So
Jean Jaurès was a socialist leader at the end of the 19th century.
The Marseillaise has also been repurposed as a feminist anthem. Louise de Chaumont wrote La Marseillaise des Cotillons, Cotillons meaning petticoats, in 1848. And it was famously recorded by Rosalie Dubois in 2008.
Les tyrans portant qu'une autre femme, notre jour est venu. Point de pitié, mettons en note tous les torts du sexe barbu. Tous les torts du sexe barbu.
So man being a savage despot who took care to proclaim his rights in 1793. Okay.
Yeah. And she continues, for our own use, let us have laws. Let's work for ourselves today. Let's make ourselves a Marseillaise. Tremble, tremble, jealous husbands. Respect to petticoats.
Respect. Well, it took a while for that respect to come. Women didn't get the right to vote, for example, in France until 1944.
Yeah, it was indeed a long struggle. One thing I've noticed in France, Sarah, I don't know if you have too, is that some French people feel uncomfortable singing La Marseillaise in public.
Well, there's not really a huge tradition of patriotism in France through symbols like the anthem or flags and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's true. And they've often been used by the far right.
Yeah.
So it becomes a little complicated sometimes. The lyrics can be seen as rather nationalistic and warmongering, and the melody, it's military, isn't it? But when the mezzo-soprano Axel Saint-Cyrel sang it at the opening of the Paris Olympics this past summer, I found it was rather spine-tingling. She was standing on top of the Grand Palais in the rain and brought out the beauty of the melody. Now, I have no scientific evidence for this, but I do wonder whether it's made some French people perhaps embrace it more heartily.
So, Allison, we've talked about AI, artificial intelligence, some around us are even using it to help with writing or organization.
I know my kids and their friends are using it, and I it's true. I've used it sometimes to help with translations.
Yeah, sure. But have you thought about where all this is happening? Mm. I mean, these so-called supercomputers that can do billions of calculations per second that drive this technology?
And there are real questions, aren't there, about just how much energy they use to do all of this.
Yeah, energy is an issue. Also, where these things are located. There's this idea of digital sovereignty. You want your data and your research and your AI to be within your jurisdiction. So France wants its own. The largest supercomputer dedicated to AI is called Jean Zay. It's named after a former French education and a fine arts minister from the 1930s. He was detained and assassinated by the Vichy government. As an aside, Jean Zay actually created the Modern Art Museum in Paris and the Cannes Film Festival. Anyway, this is a supercomputer at the University of Paris-Saclay, a massive research campus south of the capital. It's run by IDRIS, the National Research Center's, or CNRS's, High-Level Calculation and Artificial Intelligence Institute, which manages France's three national supercomputers. And I went to go meet it.
Donc là, on va passer dans la salle machine. Alors là, ça va faire beaucoup plus de bruit.
The supercomputer is a series of interconnected motherboards in a large room that greets you with a wall of noise. Fans whir and whoosh. It's so loud and constant that people working here are encouraged to wear earplugs to protect their hearing. Pierre-François Lavallée is the site's director. He walks between the refrigerator height racks that hold stacks of processors.
Voilà, c'est une armoire. Donc les lames, il y a 26 lames de calcul.
He stops in front of one and opens the back, revealing 26 blades or trays that hold four GPU graphics processors on each. Turquoise blue wires connect everything.
Elles sont toutes interconnectées les unes aux autres.
Everything is interconnected, he says. Each processor is connected to every other one in the entire room. The room is about the size of a tennis court, and there are about six rows of server racks with wires bundled above and pipes running into the floor. There's a lot going on, but it's also kind of unassuming. If you worry about AI taking over the world, it's hard to imagine that it could start here.
There's this image of the supercomputer taking over the world and so on. But you know, if you don't know how to use a supercomputer, you actually can't do much with it.
Indeed, Lavallée's job with IDRIS is to help researchers adapt their projects, their code, to this huge web of interconnected processors.
You need to adapt the code to be able to use all the parallel resources effectively, and that's not simple. You need to adapt to the memory constraints, to the ins and outs, connect to data or images that are outside of the supercomputer. It all requires a certain expertise if you want to do it well.
Si on veut être efficace.
Researchers apply to run their simulations or train their AIs on the supercomputer, and scientific committees decide who gets access. Those who do get chosen are able to use it free of charge.
C'est le ministère qui va financer l'achat des machines.
The French government pays for the machines, and we then make them available to academics or private companies as long as they conduct open research.
Open research.
Open research. Research. They have to publish all their results and data that was created on the supercomputer so everybody could see it. At any given moment, 24/7, the supercomputer is working on 1,000 different scientific projects in all kinds of fields.
Initialement, c'était essentiellement pour des problématiques de simulation.
At first, it was mostly used for simulations, for example, climate evolution. Other projects are looking for new, efficient battery components or medicines. During the pandemic, there were a lot of projects based on COVID.
Aussi sur le COVID pendant la crise sanitaire.
Today, there are artificial intelligence projects as well. Since 2019, the focus has been on enhancing AI capacity.
Le supercalculateur, quand il a été installé, il avait une petite partie.
When the supercomputer was first set up, only a small part was dedicated to AI research. Since then, that field's exploded, but we didn't have enough capacity, so we made these four extensions.
Trop limité et qu'on a eu les quatre dernières extensions.
Four extensions since 2019 to expand the computing capacity. Today, when everything's running, the supercomputer can calculate 126 petaflops, or 126 million billion calculations per second. And this requires a lot of energy.
Chaque composant consomme énormément d'énergie, et à partir de là, le supercalculateur.
Each component consumes an enormous amount of energy, and so the supercomputer itself consumes a lot, about 20 gigawatt hours per year. That's an electricity bill in France of between 3 and 5 million euros a year.
3 et 5 millions d'euros par an.
The processing uses a lot of electricity, and energy is also used to cool off the components that get very hot.
Le supercalculateur, il va faire des calculs, il va chauffer, il va générer de l'énergie.
When the supercomputer makes calculations, it heats up and generates energy. If we do nothing, the temperature will rise so much that the machine will stop. So they have to be cooled off using methods that are more or less optimized. We use what is called direct liquid cooling, using water to cool off the components, the CPUs, GPUs, memory cards, etc. The water is 30 degrees when it goes in and about 40 when it comes out.
Dans le supercalculateur et à ressort à 40 degrés.
Indeed, when you look at each blade, there are curved copper pipes winding their way between the processors and the memory chips. The small pipes are filled with water, which, along with the fans, lower the temperature so that they can continue to work. This waste heat, as it's called, is often let out into the air. But here, it's reused, transferred into a heating system to heat the building during the winter. Rafael Meteros, who works on the technical infrastructure of the supercomputer, opens the door to an area underneath, a basement level full of pipes. Down here is kind of a cross between the pipes in the belly of a cruise ship and a brewery. Big vats hold water on standby in case there's a power cut.
Nous pouvons continuer de faire fonctionner la salle machine à l'aide de ces réserves-là pendant 10 minutes.
We can continue to run the machines for 10 minutes, he explains. It gives us time to shut it down properly. Down here is also where the heat transfer happens. The supercomputer heats the campus buildings and also nearby homes. Some 6,500 megawatt hours are recuperated each year, enough to heat 1,500 houses. Mitteo says that they started doing this in 2011, and it was not really a thing back then.
En 2011, bon, cette conscience-là n'était pas aussi répandue.
It cost a bit of money, he says. It wasn't considered financially worth it. But we thought it was a pity to lose all that energy, so we tried to reduce our carbon footprint. Today, of course, energy consumption is a concern. The supercomputer here houses GPUs, graphic processors, which are not as versatile as CPUs, but they use less energy per computation. Pierre-François Lavallée says as the supercomputer has expanded, so has its electricity use, but it's become more efficient.
En 16 ans, de 2008 à 2025,
in the 16 years from 2008 to now, the machine's computing power went up 1,000-fold. Electricity consumption went up 8-fold. So we consume 8 times more energy than in 2008, but we go 1,000 times faster.
D'énergie qu'en 2008. Par contre, on va 1,000 fois plus vite.
Rafael Meteros heads out of the building, past cooling pipes outside where the hot water cools by evaporation during the summer, when it doesn't make sense to transfer the heat into the buildings. It's fairly efficient. About 80 to 90% of the heat is recovered, though he points out that's not exactly the end goal.
Il convient quand même de faire fonctionner le supercalculateur coûte que coûte.
We do need to keep the supercomputer running no matter what, he says. Ultimately, it's about doing science and not about recuperating heat.
Right, so energy use is a concern, but really, it's about how fast these machines can go, right?
Yeah. And while there are advances in trying to cool them using less energy, not everyone goes through the trouble of reusing that heat. In terms of energy, it has to be said that the majority of France's electricity is nuclear, so supercomputers and servers running in France are considered low carbon. Jansé is the largest of the national supercomputers. Another is housed by the CEA, the Atomic Energy Center. Another is in Marseille. Neither are as powerful, and they don't do as much AI. There are several projects underway, though, to build new supercomputers, more powerful, some by private companies or the Defense Department. And we've come to the end of Spotlight on France. This episode was mixed by Vincent Porat.
Spotlight on France is a production of Radio France International, RFI. If you want to send us a message, please do. You can write to us at spotlight.france@rfi.fr.
You can find photos and videos on the stories we've covered on our Instagram page, Spotlight on France. If you like the show and you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, please consider getting us a review or a rating. It does help get the word out about the show.
We'll be taking a little break and we'll be back in about a month's time at the beginning of May. Until then, why not check out our previous episodes here in your podcast app or on rfienglish.com. Bye-bye, Sarah.
Bye, Alison. Bye.